Thank you. As most of you know, the Eastern U.S. is one of eight centers of independent domestication around the world. By about 4,000 to 3,500 years ago, indigenous peoples, primarily women, had interacted with plants such as Cucurbita pipo gourd, sumpweed, quinapod, and sunflower to such an extent that morphological differences are detectable. But there are also a suite of additional starchy seeds, including maygrass and little barley, that appear in quantity. That appear in quantity and or repeatedly in samples, often alongside these domesticates, and in the case of maygrass, often outside of its outside of their natural ranges, indicating that these plants certainly must have been cultivated. My main goal in this paper today is to tie together the results of several CRM projects from sites in East Tennessee that have late archaic, early woodland, and or middle woodland components. In and of themselves, these projects include relatively few samples and therefore generally not statistically significant, but taken together, they help paint what I think is a rather interesting picture of woodland lifeways in East Tennessee. Thanks. So I'll focus here on three main projects: the Townsend Project, a locus of three multi-component sites along the Little River in Blount County at the gateway to the Great Smoky Mountain National Park; the Greene County Project, which is Greene County Project, with two multi-component sites on either side of the Nolichucky River, located in the rolling foothills of the Smokies, and Goose Creek, an early woodland site on the Tennessee River in Knoxville. You should note that all of these are adjacent to rivers. This is largely a product of the nature of CRM work in East Tennessee, which is related largely to TVA permitting processes and the fact that flat land is somewhat limited in extent but can always be found next to a waterway. So as Boyce Driscoll is fond of saying, pretty much all flat ground adjacent to water in East Tennessee is an archaeological site. Most of the data presented here derive from analyses that we have conducted over the past 9 years at the Archaeological Research Lab at UT. Flotation samples were processed using a modified SMAP machine, with heavy fractions captured using window screen and light fractions using a fine mesh. Both light and heavy fractions were analyzed using a stereoscopic microscope with 10 to 40 power magnification. All plant remains greater than 2 millimeters were identified to the lowest possible taxonomic unit, while everything less than 2 millimeters was scanned for seeds, with the exception of acorn shell, which was pulled from the 1.4 millimeter screen as well. Next slide. So let's start with the Townsend sites. Again, this is a phase three mitigation project. It's associated with the widening of U.S. Highway 21, so I'll acknowledge the TDOT, Tennessee Department of Transportation, is funding this project. So here we have a window into these sites that's approximately 300 feet wide and 2 miles long, so a long, slender window here along the Little River in East Tennessee. Next. The first significant occupation is late archaic, beginning around 2800 BCE, and is characterized by extremely large storage pits such as these. Very large storage pits, which were presumably used for storing nuts by the larger communal group. The next. The early woodland occupation, which begins around 850 BCE, is associated with several post holes, which it's hard to see here, but the purple features are late archaic, and the green ones are early woodland, and then the red ones are the early woodland post holes. So we have several post holes now and smaller pit features, suggesting more substantial dwellings and a focus on the household unit. Next. The middle woodland occupation, beginning around 200 BCE, is the densest at the site and continues all the way through around 600 CE, and includes eight structures, some of which appear to have been rebuilt. Next. And three circular features that may represent low mounds surrounded by shallow ditches. So clearly there's increasing sedentism at the site through time. Next. The plant assemblage is generally the same for each time period, dominated numerically by nutshell, but also including various fruits and native cultigens. But I'm focusing on the cultigens and nuts here. Little barley is associated with the late archaic, a few quinapod seeds with the early woodland, and maygrass and quinapod with the middle woodland, or with a few quinapod seeds with the early woodland and maygrass and quinapod with the middle woodland. A significant number of cucurbit rind fragments were also recovered from middle woodland samples. So the increasing sedentism in the middle woodland appears to be associated with a broadening of horticultural activity, which is not terribly surprising. Interestingly, the middle woodland occupants appeared to have relied heavily on acorns, with an order of magnitude increase over the early woodland. Next. The Green County project was similarly limited to the TDOT right-of-way, again giving a narrow window into these two multi-component sites on either side of the Nolichucky River. Next. The late Archaic period is represented by 60 features, the majority of which are on the eastern side of the river at the Neas site. The woodland period is better represented on the western bank at the Birdwell site, with 35 of the 48 early woodland features and 67 of the 97 middle woodland features found over here at the Birdwell site. While only several post holes or post molds were assigned to the late Archaic and early woodland occupations, 22 post holes or post molds are associated with the middle woodland occupations, particularly at the Birdwell site, again suggesting a higher degree of sedentism for these occupants. Samples from these sites include features as well as column samples from several test units due to significant accumulation of sediments here along the lower terraces of the river. Jesse Johansson analyzed the majority of these samples from these sites for her thesis research. Next. Turning to the plant samples, native cultigens are conspicuously absent from the eastern side of the river at the Neas site. There were no native cultigens found there, even though, again, we have this occupation span all the way up through. On the west side of the river, however, at the Birdwell site, we have relatively few late archaic samples, only three analyzed here, and they contained only one cucurbit rind fragment and one bear's foot seed. And I've included bear's foot here in this discussion because it frequently appears in the samples, and as part of the aster family, it has an edible oily seed similar to sunflower and sumpweed, and so it may have been used similar to these cultigens. The early woodland feature samples also include bear's foot, as well as may grass and a single kenopod seed. In contrast, the middle woodland feature samples yielded 169 kenopod seeds, as well as may grass, two bear's foot seeds, and cucurbit rind fragments. But the feature samples do not provide a good indication of the importance of native cultigens to the entire woodland occupants. Next. A series of column samples excavated from the lower terrace at the Birdwell site produce significantly more of these economic seeds. Strata 2 through 8 represent early woodland occupations. These deposits, totaling over 1.2 meters, developed relatively quickly, likely dumped as part of an active channel bar here along the river. So two AMS dates that are come from deposits from levels 70 centimeters apart yielded dates that are only 10 years apart, roughly 10 years apart. So these two here, we have very close date, a lot of sand dumped in a very short period of time. Let's see. So while our geoarchaeologist, Howard Sear, considers these lower levels to be too active for significant human occupation, too prone to flooding for people to actually occupy it, Jesse Johansson and I have found ample evidence from the flotation samples to suggest that while they may not have been building their dwellings on this lower terrace, they appear to have been managing fields of native cultigens here. Next. Significant numbers of maygrass, little barley, kenopod, and bear's foot seeds, as well as cucurbit rind fragments, were recovered from these early woodland column samples. Interestingly, the samples from the upper stratum, stratum 1 here, which spans from the end of the early woodland through the Mississippian period, lack any of the little barley. It falls out completely. The occupants appear to have relied more heavily on kenopod and maygrass instead. Indeed, the feature samples at Birdwell site also lacked little barley altogether, but also showed an increase in kenopod. Whether this apparent shift away from little barley and increase in kenopod use is real or an artifact of sample size remains to be seen. In either case, while large quantities of seeds were not recovered from any particular context, the repeated recovery of native cultigens from the samples, particularly the column samples along the lower terrace, suggests to us that early woodland gardeners were actively tending this landform, likely repeatedly burning it, perhaps to remove early successional saplings with the aim of maintaining these garden plots. Next. Okay, so now we're moving to Knoxville and the Goose Creek site. It's on the south side of the Knoxville waterfront and is more limited in time depth, with primarily an early woodland occupation and a very brief overlying middle woodland occupation, but we're going to focus on the early woodland because we can see it better here. Next. The primary deposit at Goose Creek is a midden, approximately 50 centimeters thick, accompanied by several prehistoric pits, post molds, a lithic concentration, and two so-called smudge pits filled with charred cane. Next. The 8 feature samples and 15 midden column samples show a similar trend in plant use, with the Goose Creek occupants supplementing nuts with native cultigens, namely maygrass and kenopod. They also grew cucurbits and apparently bear's foot. Next. Interestingly, the column samples suggest a decrease in maygrass through time, and kenopod seeds were only found in levels 5 and 6, while bear's foot seeds were only found in levels 1 through 3. So there may be some kind of change through time here. While the occupation at Goose Creek does not give us much indication of change through time, however, as it's primarily limited to the early woodland, there are hints at nearby sites of increasing use of this stretch of the Tennessee River. Next. Downstream at Cherokee Farm, phase 2 investigations have found several each of late archaic, early woodland, and middle woodland features. Over here, this is Cherokee Farm site along there. But similar to Goose Creek, an early woodland midden is present at this site. A flotation sample from an early woodland feature here yielded 9 kenopod seeds. Late archaic and early woodland components appear to be present across the river at 40K and 16, what is now the UT Institute of Agriculture campus. And then similarly, upstream from Goose Creek at River Plain Park site, all 3 components appear to be present, the late archaic, early, and middle woodland sites. So while investigations along the river in Knoxville have by no means been systematic, there does appear to seem some general level of increased use beginning in the late archaic and at key spots along the river, with woodland peoples filling in locations between these prime areas on the river. And this is what we'd expect to see, an increase in the number of sites and in the apparent intensity of site use through time. The fact that this coincides with the increasing use of native cultigens has also been noted previously by researchers. But what I do find interesting is the possible trend in little barley, maygrass, and kenopod through time. Little barley and maygrass appear to be more prevalent in the late archaic and early woodland deposits, and then kenopod more prevalent in the middle woodland. We've seen this at Townsend and at the Greene County sites, and to some degree at Goose Creek. Next. More limited investigations at other sites in the region may also suggest this. 30 samples from early woodland contacts at Phipps Bend, further to the northeast, include only kenopod seeds, with a count of 148, and no other cultigens, although over 50 grass family seeds were identified. At the McCullough's Bend site to the north in Claiborne County, samples from 2 middle woodland features there yielded 377 kenopod seeds, only 9 maygrass seeds, and 2 cucurbit rind fragments. Interestingly, the Tellico sites lacked little barley altogether. The 43 late archaic Savannah River phase samples from Bacon Bend only contained 1 kenopod seed as compared with 130 maygrass seeds, but the 72 samples from late archaic Iddens context contained 47 kenopod seeds and only 1 single maygrass seed, as well as 1 sunflower seed and 1 bear's foot seed. 78 early woodland samples from early middle woodland context, from early woodland context at Rose Island, Callaway Island, and the Patrick site produced 1,400 kenopod seeds and 4 bear's foot seeds, but no other native cultigens. The 160 middle woodland samples from Ice House Bottom trend back in the other direction, with 131 maygrass seeds and only 60 kenopod seeds. So we have a number of data points now, and these numbers continue to grow as CRM and academic research projects continue in East Tennessee. But can we meaningfully connect these dots? Perhaps not. First, there are different idiosyncrasies in each of the assemblages from the sites. Several of the sites or the time periods within each site are represented by only a few samples. If additional samples could be analyzed, any apparent patterns may smooth out. Even for the larger assemblages, one or two features may yield the vast majority of a particular seed or even acorn shell. This kind of hit-or-miss luck provides excellent information about food processing activities associated with that feature, but sometimes it is not clear how it applies to an understanding of the typical or overall importance of a particular plant resource, not just in the diet, but in shaping the gardeners and gatherers' day-to-day activities and seasonal activities. It is also quite possible that plant food use is very particular to each site, depending on a number of ecological and social variables. at the ecological level, a lot of these are shaped by the plant resources available in the general vicinity of each site. But human actions and intentions are laid over these, at which point decisions about seasonal movements and the timing of visits to particular sites, as well as the length of stays and range of activities performed at each site, come into play and intersect with local plant availability. Next. But it's also possible. That's all right. It's just a pretty picture at the end anyway. But it's also possible that this general vague pattern will bear out in additional samples as additional samples are analyzed in the region. It is tempting to consider little barley and maygrass as prime cultivated resources available in late spring and early summer, presumably when stored foods began to run low. Just as important may be the fact that their harvest does not overlap with the availability of other important staples, namely nuts, those hickory nuts and acorns, as well as chestnuts and black walnuts, which must be gathered during a relatively short window in autumn. When maygrass and little barley ripen in late May and June, there are relatively few scheduling contexts then. Relatively few scheduling conflicts then. Associating an increase in use of kenopod then with increasing sedentism may suggest that by the earlier middle woodland period, East Tennessee horticulturalists were confident enough in the likelihood that they would return to a particular habitation area between late summer and early winter when kenopod seeds are generally available. By growing them in plots close to home, they could also more easily schedule the harvesting of these starchy seeds among other food procurement and processing activities. With our larger scale picture relatively well sketched out throughout the eastern woodlands, with a well-established framework of use of native cultigens broadly across the eastern woodlands, paleoethnobotanists have been turning their attention to smaller interregional scales to better understand why some of these cultigens and domesticates became staple crops in some areas but not in others. As we continue to increase our sample size and take the scale of investigation to the levels of individual sites, for example, again, at these two sites on the Green River, the Birdwell and Nias sites that are directly across the river from each other with very, very different pictures in these native plant crop uses, the picture becomes all the more complex and I think all the more interesting as well. Thank you very much.